We finished the previous chapter or section of the last reading, and this next one is called Polishing the Shell, and this is about monastic life. The epigraph at the front of the paragraph at the front of the chapter is: Abandoning the dark way, let the wise cultivate the bright path. Having gone from home to homelessness, let them yearn for that delight in detachment, so difficult to enjoy. Giving up sensual pleasures with no attachment, let the wise cleanse themselves of defilements of mind. So from verses from the Dhammapada. Introduction. Lumpur Cha chose to live his life as a Buddhist monk. He received permission from his parents to enter a monastery at the age of 9, and apart from a brief period in his teens, he lived in monastic communities until his death at the age of 74. The Sangha was his family, and, as a teacher, its welfare was his main preoccupation. While he gave considerable importance to propagating the Dhamma in society at large, he did so only to the extent that it did not compromise his training of the monks and nuns in his monastery. Lumpur considered that the longevity and good health of Buddhism in a society was ultimately decided by the quality of the monastic order. He spent much of his life providing a training for monastics that was intended to be true to the ancient principles, but that would, at the same time, also enable the Sangha to thrive in a Thailand that was rapidly changing. Perhaps most crucially, he sought to create a Sangha that was not overly tied to him as an individual, but would still be able to thrive in his eventual absence. When Lumpur established Wat Bopong in 1954, there were few precedents for him to draw upon. No clear-cut forest monastery template passed down by his teachers to conform to. Scarcely a decade had passed since Lungpul Man himself, the father of the tradition, had first spent 2 consecutive rains retreats in the same monastery. Nevertheless, it seems evident that Lumpur had been preparing for this new development in his life for some time, closely observing the way that things were done in every monastery he practiced in during his Tudong years. He began with great confidence, establishing a monastery based broadly upon Lungpul Man's monastery at Nong Pur, but also introducing certain adaptations inspired by practices he had seen elsewhere, and others from his own ideas. From the beginning, he showed a willingness to learn from experience and discard what did not work. So he took Lumpul Man as his teacher and his exemplar, but as he says, Lumpul Man didn't actually spend 2 consecutive years in the same place, right until the last 5 years of his life. In his old age, he travelled from place to place and deliberately didn't set up a fixed monastery to be living in. He was famously, when he was appointed, without his knowledge, he was appointed the abbot of a monastery in Chiang Mai. He disappeared into the hills and was not seen for about 10 years by anyone other than the local villagers. And so this is very relevant that Lumpur Cha had, had in his mind one day of setting up a monastery, and had, as he said, been taking notes or been, alert to the different standards and forms that were employed in the different places where he had stayed. Were various different teachers, along with a few days that he had with Lumpur Man. He spent quite a bit of time with Lumpur Kinnari, with Lumpur Tongrat, other Ajahns in the Ubon area. And so from the style of the places that they had and his understanding and his experience of the style of practice with Lumpur Man, then he let that form the pattern of a practice and training that he established in his own place. So he earlier in the book, it's talked about him having he was born in 1918. He became a bhikkhu in 1938, I believe, and so then he established Wat Bopong 1954. So that he was about 16 reigns as a monk when Wat Bopong began. The next section is called Chaff from the Grain. So chaff is the husk, or the part of a grain that you can't eat. So the grain, when you are harvesting corn or those kind of cereals, then one of the parts of the process of treating the grain to, or getting the grain so that it can be used, like with rice or corn or wheat and such like, is separating the chaff from the grain, so that you have the grain which you can eat and becomes flour or rice or whatever, is separated from the chaff, which is the hard husky skin that goes around the grain. One of the distinctive features of the Wat Bapong training was the unusually long time, in some periods almost 2 years, that aspirants lived in the monastery first as postulants and then as novices before taking full ordination. This was a radically different approach to that found in the village and city monasteries. Screening applicants for admission into the Sangha and requiring them to spend a probationary period as postulants may seem to be a matter of common sense, but it was virtually unknown at that time. In most monasteries, applicants could expect to be wearing a monk's robes within days of walking through the gate, a custom that contributed significantly to low standards throughout the monastic order. A probationary period served to make ordination seem more valuable. Lumpur expressed his view on the matter in a characteristically succinct phrase: easy to ordain, easy to disrobe. Difficult to ordain, difficult to disrobe. So that was a very often repeated phrase. Also, an alternative to that, or very similar meaning, is bort rao suk rao, which is like you ordain quickly, you disrobe quickly. So that was a part of his process, was to say have that period of time where an individual is learning the ropes and getting familiar with the monastic training, and also feeling out their own commitment, also for the community to be able to see whether that person was trainable, or whether it was going to be a life that was really going to suit them, and also that that this was not just from Lumpu Cha himself, but it was also one of the things that he had derived from living with Lumpu Man, who would similarly keep people in a probationary state for quite some time. I even heard of one candidate with Lumpu Man, who was kept as a pakao and anagarika for 6 years before he would allow him to take the ordination, so that bhikkhu ordination, so that this wasn't just Lumpu Cha's creation, but he picked that up from the standard that Lumpu Man had established. Also, in the languaging of this, the way Ajahn Jayasaro is speaking, and through much of the book, is talking about the monk's ordination process, or the monk's training as an anagarika, then a samanera, then as a bhikkhu, the three-stage process, and that the training for nuns in Thailand was just to the eight precepts. And there's a whole chapter on the nuns' training that we will come to as the retreat period proceeds, so that particularly for the nuns' community and for the women, the languaging here is about the men's ordination, and in the main part. So I encourage people to be doing an internal translation of that as we go along, so that it's and then the training that's been established here in the West for the Sila Dara community, where they have rather than having a three-stage process, is a two-stage process, I would say, and then the Anagarika training is for at least 2 years, correct? At least 2 years, and then after that two-year period, if they're considered suitable as candidates, then they can be accepted as Sila Dara if they ask for the going forth, if they're considered suitable. So and in the West, for our communities, then pretty much all of the different branches around the world, it's a 1 year period for the men on the eight precepts as an anagarika, and then a 1 year period as a samanera, as a novice, and then again, if they request bhikkhu ordination at the end of that 2 year period and they're considered suitable, then they can be accepted. But it's I don't think any of our branches around the world have anything less than a 2 year training period, and then with a period of time as a layperson living in a monastery with a sort of a preliminary training period, then it's usually at least 2.5 years from the time somebody first comes and gets accepted as a long-term guest to when they have they've made a full commitment. In Thailand, it's a little quicker. So at Wat Phananachat, then for the men going into training there, then it's often, I think, about 6 months as an anagarika, as a pakao, a white-robed postulant, and then maybe 6 or 9 months as a novice. It's a slightly shorter period, and that's somewhat based on the fact that it's in a Buddhist country, and there's much more of a strong, supportive sort of Buddhist tradition, Buddhist customs are all around, but also it's somewhat guided by immigration needs and to get a visa for a long-term stay is less complicated if you are in the bhikkhu form, and so that it's a mixture of both the training principles and the legalities of living in Thailand as a foreigner. So I couldn't swear to exactly how long it is in Wat Phananachat. But I get the impression it's generally about 15 to 18 months from the time somebody arrives. We got any Wat Phananachat hatched Sangha members here? And Tana Jim Lai Mai? Where they? Ti Wat Pa Phong. When you come to Wat Pa Phong, for how long will it be if you go to stay as a...
Pakao or depending on Lumpur, maybe it's 4 months, 5 months.
And then as summon in?
4 or 5 months, and depend on
Lumpur
as well.
Oh, it's a Lumpurium, yeah. So it could be less than a year. Yeah.
Maybe less.
Yeah, people cook at different rates. Mm-hmm. So that's what when people ask. Oftentimes, people come to visit and they say, who are the ones in white and who are the ones in brown and. So I often say that the ones in white, the ones that they haven't been in the cooker very long, like tofu. You know, it goes brown after it's been baked for a considerable amount of time. So. At Wat Pa Phong, those unsuited for monastic life usually left well before the ceremony of ordination. New people were tested from the first day. A freshly arrived applicant for ordination at Wat Pa Phong would spend the first few days in a state of some confusion, receiving little attention and sleeping at night on a rush mat at the back of the Dhamma hall. Ajahn Tieng recalled, Lumpur would leave the newly arrived people alone. He didn't speak to them apart from asking them how they were now and then. Whether they did things right or wrong, he said nothing. He'd just leave them for about a week or 5 days or 3 days, depending on the circumstance, and then he would speak. I thought it was an excellent method to get an idea of the person's intelligence. Was he aware of what was going on around him? Was he being observant? Was he foolish, unobservant, or impulsive? Once Lumpur had grasped his weak points, his basic personality, then he'd start to teach and train him. Ajahn Jundi, one of those who passed through this process with distinction, saw others leave after a few days. Lumpur was unconcerned. His attitude was, whoever wants to come, let them come. Whoever wants to leave, let them leave. It didn't affect him. I came as a layperson, and I was here for around 10 days before anyone said anything to me. The monks and novices didn't speak to me or teach me anything or ask me to help with anything at all. I thought, why am I being left to my own devices like this? I'd just been abandoned. Sometimes I started to feel miserable and considered going home. It seemed from the way that everybody was behaving that nobody was interested in me. Realizing that the onus was upon him to make the effort to watch those around him closely and copy them in whatever he could, Ajahn Jundi's willingness to learn was noticed, and his life in the monastery soon began to change for the better. After some days, the applicant would be told that he could now shave his head, signifying an initial commitment to the abandonment of vanity and the practice of renunciation. He would then formally request the 8 precepts and begin wearing the white lower robe and angsa of the postulant. The one shoulder robe of the upper garment. From this point, his training would begin. He would join in most of the Sangha's communal activities, assist the monks, and start learning the daily chants. And this is, again, Ajahn Jandi speaking. I wanted to ordain quickly, but Lumpur explained about the training of new people, and it made sense to me. He was quite stern with my group. He said he wasn't going to let us ordain easily. He would train us like soldiers. We had come to be soldiers of the Buddha, and we needed some basic training, like army boot camp. It might take many months or even a year if we weren't any good. For those who badly wanted to ordain, it took the wind out of their sails. In those days, he aimed at quality above all. He wasn't bothered by the reactions of the people who came. He wanted to test their faith. The smarter people ordained more quickly because they were fluent, able to do everything in a neat, correct way. Others were there for a year or two, and they still weren't ready. If they could endure, they stayed. If they couldn't, they left. He didn't ever try to persuade anyone to stay. Some people would arrive saying they were tired of the world, they'd had their fill of it, but then they came up against the monastic regulations, and a single day was enough. By the next morning, they changed their minds and left. Although it was true they came with faith, they lacked wisdom. Some didn't even pay respects before they left. They just ran away. Some people stayed a bit longer, shaved their heads, and then left. I know so many people who were unable to endure it. And sometimes that lack of ability to endure can take shape very, very quickly. I remember one Anagarika who was here, who'd come with a lot of faith and commitment, had really sort of put his heart into the training. And then I was after the kind of morning meeting, and the breakfast time was over. I was sitting here with Ajahn Sujito. Lumpur was away at that time, and this particular Anagarika came up and said, "Ajahn's, I have to tell you, I need to leave." So at first we thought, "Oh, he's got some kind of family emergency," and we said, "Oh, so what's up? You know, your mum or your dad? Are they unwell?" And he said, "No, I have to leave. I need to disrobe." I said, "Oh, okay. Well, that's a change. So, well, Lumpur will be back in about, you know, 4 or 5 days. You know, just you can talk to him then and then go through it." He said, "No. I might last until 9 o'clock." It was about 8:15 at that point. And we looked at him, both of us looked at him and thought, he means it. Yeah. So we worked something out with him, and he did indeed leave. But sometimes that it's called the burning robe. The when your robe's on fire, it's a non conceptual state. But it's just like if your robe's on fire, you think, well, should I take it off or just leave it on? Well, it's only burning a little bit. You know, it's like, get me out of here. Anyone who expressed desire or showed impatience in Lumpur's presence could expect to pay a price. If a new member of the community wanted to ordain as soon as possible, the worst thing that he could do would be to request a date from Lumpur, or almost an unthinkable... If a new member of the community wanted to ordain as soon as possible, the worst thing that he could do would be to request a date from Lumpur, or, almost unthinkable, except perhaps for one of the Westerners, to pester him. They'd say, "Come on, Lumpur, please, give me a date. I mean, I'm really keen. I need to ordain." That's to pester, to kind of be a pest. The question, "Lumpur, when will I be ordained?" would either be completely ignored or dismissed with a "don't bother," or "it's not really necessary, just carry on as you are." Only when Lumpur saw that the eager aspirant was at peace with whatever his teacher decided, did he arrange for an ordination. One of the most valuable phrases a new member of the community would learn at Wobbapong was, "It's up to you, Lumpur." It meant that he trusted Lumpur's judgment and could be patient for however long it took. So that's in the Thai language, that's Lat Dae Lumpur. Excuse my bad pronunciation. Lat Dae Lumpur. Well, whatever Lumpur wishes, it's up to you. So that's that usually shows a kind of graciousness and a readiness to be ready to fit in and to follow the teacher's perception. And so that for my ordination in 1979, I the I'd requested permission from the abbot of Wat Phalanachat, Ajahn Prabhakaro, and he'd talked about it with Lumpur Cha and said, yeah, you can learn the chanting, get ready. And that was about January or February. And so we were practicing the chanting and getting ready, and just February went by, March went by, and so occasionally I'd say, has Lumpur talked about a date for the ordination? He said, no. Yeah, don't think about it, don't worry about it. And then what happened was, he was about to go travelling to the West for the second time in the spring, in May, or late April, early May of 79. And we just got a message. A layman came over with a little written note saying, Prabhakara, if you've got any candidates for ordination, bring them over this evening. That was it. It was like I had about 5 hours preparation to get over there, and then joined in with the group of people that were also having their Upasampada, that were full ordination at that time. And that was it. It was just, okay, keep your bowl, we're going over. And that was my Upasampada. So it was very little warning, but you know, but as he says here, if you were pestering or you were eager, then that's what you would learn about. So look, and it also shows a very strong principle that's come up many, many times in reading a biography, and either if you've been listening to these readings that I've given or you've been reading it yourself, that Lumpur Cha was very much a user of situations. He was a situational teacher. So he would, along with giving discourses from the Dhamma seat or people coming to see him and ask questions, then he would use the day-to-day circumstances of living and community, the dynamics of community life, and the sort of need to look after the place and building projects and keeping the place clean and tidy, or all the different aspects of living together, as teaching opportunities. And so that Lumpur would consider that waiting for a date for an ordination ceremony as much part of your spiritual training as sitting with your eyes closed in the meditation hall or doing walking meditation at your kuti. He wouldn't make a distinction between one as a more important or significant learning situation than another. And so that and then he was very observant and alert. So he would watch and see what the kind of needs were for individual people. And so if someone was always avoiding responsibility, he'd put them up front. If people were eager for responsibility, he'd leave them at the back. And so that that kind of using of the situations of ordinary living was very much a part of the way of life and practice and training there. Are there any questions, thoughts on that?
There's always a tension, isn't there, between people who want to things to be very organized and very kind of regulated, that sort of style where really personality is rather unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your any thoughts about the kind of advantages and disadvantages exposed?
You mean like have we sort of arrange a date and then have it months in advance?
Well, just the kind of style, you know. Like many monasteries are extremely regulated. It's all very regimented. And Ajahn Chah's style always seemed to be, you know, he knew what he was doing, but nobody else did, and you really had to fit in with that and be prepared for things to be unpredictable.
It's a lot to do with the mindset of being in Asia or in the West, and so it's not just a matter of sort of Lat Deh Lumpur, whatever the Ajahn wants, but that the whole sense of when something is going to happen and when it, or if it's not going to happen, or how many days you're going to spend in one particular place. The whole society seems to have a lot more, like in Thailand, as probably other, same in other countries as well in the East. But There's a general flexibility about when people are coming, when they're going, how many days you're going to spend in one place, or who's going to look after certain projects or whatever. Then there's a sort of group assumption that, okay, we can adapt if to circumstances. We don't have to have it pinned down. And in the West, it people tend to have much more regimentation and having things fixed and arranged. And so it's a kind of societal style is a lot of it, I feel. And so that Wat Pho Phong was very regimented with flexibility, with the uncertainty principle, the Lumpur Cha uncertainty principle, Heisenberg's uncertainty. You never quite knew what was going to happen. But so I was in the early days of Abhayagiri in California. You get this sort of idea, okay, when I have my own monastery, I'm going to make it more flexible. We're far too regimented. Everything is far too sort of fixed and orderly, and we're tied to the calendar and so forth. And I really think when I have my own monastery, it's going to be much more flexible. I think we should have more of this. So that thought was in the back of my mind. Foolish. Foolish though it was. So anyway, in the early days of Abhayagiri, I'd been invited to do some teaching event off further inland in California, over in the across the other side of the east side of the Central Valley, and I was in that that kind of Sacramento area. I was been at this place giving a day of teachings and a talk in the local center and such like. And then I knew, okay, there's not much on the calendar at Abhayagiri. Maybe I could, and the people have asked me to stay, I'll just maybe just send a message back to Abhayagiri and say, I'll be here for another couple of days, I'll come back. I'll come back a couple of days later than planned. And people were not happy. I deliberately and consciously thought, okay, here's a good opportunity to exercise some flexibility in the schedule. I said I was going to come back on the Tuesday, I'll just come back on the Friday instead. And it was really quite a strong reaction. I thought, okay, so even that much, there was really no thing I had to be doing. Lumpur Prasanna was there as well, Abhayagiri. I didn't have to be there, quote unquote. But no, it didn't go down well, and I thought, well, I did have that in the back of my mind, but I'll just leave it out in future, because people, there's just not a mindset that people are comfortable with. It's like, where are you? We were worried about you. Well, what's going on? What's happening? Whereas, rather than worrying about, well, why has it changed, or what's going on, in Thailand, it'd be like, well, yeah, of course, who knows when the Ajahn will be back. And taking the opportunity to have that kind of flexibility, I feel it's a useful thing in our training. And so when people go on Tudong, I think it's a very good thing now that you don't really have a fixed plan. You don't know where you're going to be staying which route you're going to take or where you're going to be. And so there is that fluidity, that flexibility in things, and that. That is one situation where we can exercise that. So, but I think it's to do with being mindful of the time and the place and the situation. And so that if you're living in a country that really likes, everyone's expecting regularity and commitment, just to try and sustain that kind of unfixity, it can be really hard work. Yeah. Any other questions, thoughts? I was asking about the routine at Buddha Bodhiwana Monastery in Melbourne. So they have a little bit more flexibility there in terms of I think you were talking about what work was going to happen, who was going to do what.
Yeah, they have a weekly change of schedule, actually. So they have
evening meetings, morning meetings, and work periods are assigned weekly, which days we do what.
And the Ajahn just decides what's going to happen each week.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I was interested to hear that, but it sounds like too much work for me. But changing the routine at Amravati every on a weekly basis, I think there'd be a lot of a lot of meetings and communication methods. That whiteboard would have to cover the whole wall. But regularity in having commitments and schedules, I feel it's not something that's intrinsically limiting or imprisoning. It can simplify things, and that's part of the many, many details of monastic training and the etiquette that we follow. A lot of the spirit behind it, the principle, is that because we have the right way of doing things and the wrong way of doing things for so many details of our life, it does keep it very, very simple. And so that it's a it can seem like a lot of rules to follow, but then if everyone knows what the rules are and everyone keeps them, then it helps things to flow along quite smoothly. It's like driving, like on the road, there's all kinds of rules that people have to keep driving a vehicle, but then what that means, if everyone is keeping the rules of the road in an appropriate way, then thousands and thousands of cars can get along the M25 or down the A4146 and get where they want to go without crashing into each other, and those journeys can be made, and people can carry out their business easily and effectively. So there are a lot of rules you have to follow if you're driving, but that is there to facilitate your freedom of movement. So our monastic rule is a very, very similar spirit.
Ajahn, I was wondering your thoughts on also talking about setting up monasteries and what kind of role models or what we're looking at, how you were seeing that when you came to the West, and what you looked at and how you felt in adapting tradition to modern Western society. Mm-hmm. And all those kind of things.
Well, I was extremely junior. I mean, I had precisely one reins as a monk when I came back to the West. So I was in a very junior position. It was very much, in that era, it was also Lap Dai Lung Po, whatever Ajahn Sumedho wants, that's what happens. And that was the case all the way up until about 18. So I came back in the autumn of 79, and that was pretty much the way that all of our places ran in Britain, at least. And that was until about 86 or 87. And that's when Lung Po Sumedho established the eldest, it's called the Terror Council. Then none of the nuns had 10 reigns by that time, so it was just called the Elders Council, and he started to deliberately diversify share the decision making. But up until about 1986, it was just whatever Ajahn Sumedho wants, that's what happens. And so it was very much a sort of individual centric process. And so when he first came to London, as you know, that he didn't even know he was going to be staying. They thought we were going to be there for 2 months. And then Lung Po Cha announced, as in the kind of Lap Dai Lung Po, Lung Po Cha, he didn't discuss it with Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Kemadhamma. He just told them, I'm going back in July, you're staying. That was like, they didn't have a vote. So, I'm going back, you're going to stay, and then we'll invite Anando and Viradhamma to join you. Because they were both fairly junior, I think. Ajahn Anando was about 4 vasa, Ajahn Viradhamma about 3, and they were visiting family in North America, Ajahn V in Canada, and Ajahn Anando in New York State, and so they joined them. So then it became clear that Ajahn Sumedho was going to be staying from that summer of 77, and so they got to know the people at the Hampstead Vihara, the English Sangha Trust group that was invited them, and then people like the Buddhist Society, then people like Dr. Saratissa, who was the abbot of the London Buddhist Vihara, and then various different groups that were there in England. And he said that what was happening was that people had all sorts of ideas about what they should and shouldn't be doing, and so that When they first came, one of the things was that at the Hampstead Vihara was that they always sat to meditate on chairs because the only hippies sit on the floor. So we don't want Buddhism to come across as some sort of hippie religion. So they had their meditations, everyone was sitting on chairs, apparently. So then they received that feedback. No, you can't sit on the floor to meditate. No, that's the sort of thing the hippies do. So we don't do that. You know? And so from the beginning, then he said, well, let's just do it the way we do. Well, okay, thank you for sharing. this is the way we do it. I can't really imagine not sitting on the floor to meditate. So let's just adapt. And if people accuse us of being hippies or get upset with us, then we can maybe adapt if we need to. But let's just see. And that became the guiding principle, was that hearing what people's advice was and then changing things as and when they needed to. So first of all, they would go on Bindabat barefoot. They'd go on arms around. Ajahn Chah was very insistent they should go out on arms around every day in London. And so they would go out barefoot. And then as winter came on, so at the end of 1977 and beginning of 78, then they would come back to the Vihara with blue feet, you know, from the walking along the London pavements, and people go, oh, Ajahn Sumedho, your feet are blue, you're freezing, your toes are going to fall off, you're going to get frostbite. And so there's so much distress from people, okay, I think we need to wear shoes. And so then they started, which in Thailand is unthinkable to wear sandals on the arms round. It's completely, right, absolutely no way would you ever do that. So, okay, well, it's in Thailand you'd never do that. Okay, but the weather's a lot colder here, so okay, we'll just start wearing sandals, because they needed to. Similarly with, I think it was when Ajahn Chah came in 77, and that they were there in May, but it snowed while they were in the Hampstead Vihara in May, so they were all going in the Vihara. They were having the robes over one shoulder with a bare shoulder, and then in one day it was very cold weather. It started snowing, and so Ajahn Ananda would often tell the story. Say, Lumpur, it's snow. Have you ever seen snow before? And he said, shut the window. Not interested in the excitement of seeing snow, but it's like, oh, this is freezing. So then they would be wearing sweatshirts or whatever, pullovers and t-shirts and things to stave off the cold. And Lumpur Cha thought, well, this is pretty untidy. It's really cold, and so having a bare shoulder is really chilly, so people want to wear some extra layers, but it's really untidy, the sort of mess of t-shirts and sweatshirts and pullovers and such like. So he said, better to wear your robes over both shoulders. So for the first several years, when I came to England, we would wear, for the pujas in the monastery, we wore the robe over both shoulders, because Lumpur said it's tidier that way. Everyone is neatly dressed in the same way, and you can wear as many layers or whatever you like to underneath. So and that was Lumpur Cha's instruction, adapting to the cold weather. And then we started, these jackets actually came into being when Ajahn Manindo joined us from New Zealand. And so Chithurst had been established, I think it was about 1980 or 81, and he was called Upano then, Tan Upano was his name at that time. So he had been visiting family in New Zealand, and he asked if he could come and join us in England, because he had a lot of difficulty with the Asian climate in Thailand, and so he wanted to come and live in a cooler place. And in New Zealand, he had met this a New Zealand monk out of the Korean tradition called Hamwol, Venerable Hamwol. And he noticed that he had this kind of jacket that was looked fairly neat. And he was quite a good sewer. Ajahn Manindo was a good at sewing and robe making and such like. So he got the details of how the jacket was made from Hamwol. And so then, because he'd heard this, that in England we were wearing the robes over the shoulders, and so he got a pattern design worked out from chatting with this Korean tradition monk. And then, so when he came to England, he said to Ajahn Sumedho, if we had a standardized jacket, then we could go back to wearing the robe over one shoulder. We could both keep warm in the winter and also be a bit more uniform, and then keep the tradition of being one, having the robe over one shoulder inside the monastery. And so Dhunpo Sumedho said, okay, we'll just make up a few samples and we'll see what they look like and try it out. And so very quickly that was adopted, and people thought, oh, that's a great idea. It works in a very neat way to both adapt to the colder climate and also be able to keep to the traditions of having the robe over one shoulder inside the monastery. So that changing things as we needed to along the way. And the basic principle, if it needs to change, we can change it. If it doesn't need to change, don't change it. So then people said, you'll need to use money. You can't possibly live in the West without using money. So that's got to go. You can't have that sort of custom of not using money. As for just like with the same kind of vehemence as saying, well, you can't sit on the floor. But again, he said, well, thank you for sharing, and well, we'll see. We'll try and live without money and see whether it really is possible. And they tried it out, and they realized, yeah, we can. There's no need. Because people say, oh, you can't travel on the tube, or you're going to need to go on buses. And so then they realized, well, no, if you set things up in the right way, you have a layperson going along, or somebody buys you tickets in advance, you can do it. It's all workable. And so then that was never questioned. After that time, they said, yeah, we can. Very quickly, it was shown that you could live without using money. So okay, well, that was someone's thought. You have to have money, and it was shown to be not the case. So some things they came up, and then they made changes. Some things came up, and they didn't make changes. And that was politely receiving people's feedback, and then exploring it, then seeing what worked. And so we still have these. I mean, there's a few different styles now. We have the buttons down the middle now. This is a different style jacket, but most people are wearing these Korean style ones with the four tags. It was interesting that there was in Korea there's a small movement to re-establish or to establish interest in the Pali Canon and the Theravada teachings. And this a couple of senior Korean monks came to visit Abhayagiri. And that they, as one who had been a university professor and had been teaching Pali and was trying to get the Pali canon translated into Korean script, and spent years and years teaching his students to do the Pali to Korean translations and putting all the Pali words into Korean script, and it's a long, long project. And he'd come to visit. And he was so excited to see our jackets. And this is a classical Korean jacket. Where did you get these from? And they're in your color. How did you get these? Well, we make them. Yeah. And so that he was very pleased to see that sort of sharing of traditions also, that via a circuitous route where we have a threads from Korea, literally, no pun intended, threads from Korea coming into to play, because it's a cold country, and Korea's, their winters are much colder than here, 20 below, 30 below, lots of snow. So that kind of readiness to adapt if need be, and then sharing of customs and traditions, I feel that's the basic principles of establishing new places. And then you see what's needed in different countries, what fits in, what doesn't fit in. Okay, so the next one is called Going Forth. Novice ordination has traditionally been the de facto option for males below the age of 20, with men of 20 years or above taking full monk ordination without becoming novices first. Lumpur was unusual in that for a number of years he required men of all ages to spend a period of months as a novice before becoming monks. It gave aspirants for monkhood the chance to develop a feel for Sangha life with many of the trappings of the life as a monk, but without the immediate pressure of having to conform to a large, complex body of training rules. Eventually, he relaxed this practice somewhat, but retained it for Westerners and elderly men who benefited from this gentle introduction to Sangha life. The novice ordination ceremony, pabaja, literally going forth, is short. The aspirant receives robes from the teacher, makes his formal request to go forth, receives the 10 precepts from the teacher, and recites a list of the 5 basic meditation topics: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. On one such going forth ceremony, Lumpur gave the following instruction: "The only reason that I make it so difficult for all of you to enter the Sangha here is that I want things to be done well. Taking the time is the proof of your commitment. Some people want to become monks, but then when they find out that it takes a long time, they change their minds. Some bear with it, some leave and seek to become monks elsewhere. I have no objections to that, but what I have always insisted upon is that becoming a monk is not taken lightly. As postulants, as postulants, you've trained and prepared yourselves to become a monk. You've lived with the monks, learned how to offer things to them correctly, learned about the monk's life, become acquainted with it. You've practiced sewing and dyeing cloth, looking after robes and bowls. You've seen how the monks practice with regard to robes, alms round, dwelling place, medicines. Now you must be willing to conduct yourselves in the same way. This is the foundation. Now that you've learned the basics, you can become a novice. I'll give you a bowl, and tomorrow morning you'll put on your robes neatly and walk for alms in the village. Tomorrow, the villagers will put fresh cooked rice in your bowl. They will pay their respects to you. Why will these old people with grey hair hold up their hands in respect to you? Because of the power of the ochre robe. This ochre robe belongs to the Buddha. It has an incomparable power. If you use it in the wrong way, you will degrade yourself. There are a great number of Dhamma teachings to learn, but today, on the day of novice ordination, there are just a few. Following the tradition handed down from the great teachers of old, today we study the 5 meditation objects: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. When you first hear the list, it may sound a bit comical, but if you contemplate these 5 things well, it will become really profound. We are born with these things, but we don't know them. It's necessary to learn these 5 fundamental meditation objects as the entrance to the path that leads directly to Nibbana. Herein lies right view. We are taught to learn these 5 basic meditation objects and then reflect on them. Repeat after me in the scriptural language: Kesa, Loma, Naka, Danta, Tacho. Tacho, Danta, Naka, Loma, Kesa. Some people say that everyone has these things. They know what they are already. Why study them? But they don't really know what they are. They don't know the true nature of head hair, of body hair, of nails, of teeth, or of skin. Hair of the head is, in fact, repulsive. Where does it come from? It feeds on pus. Not exactly, but slightly biologically imaginative, if I respectfully offer that. The others are the same. These things are not glowing with health, you know. They're not delightful, but we don't really see that. It's the flawed parts that people beautify, the unattractive parts. It's because of their great dirtiness that people pretty them up. Is there really anything beautiful about head hair? No, there isn't. Is it clean? There's nothing clean about it. If you heaped up a pile of hair and left it by the side of the road, would anyone pick it up? Take off your skin. Put it by the side of the road, and then tomorrow on alms round, see if anyone has gone off with it yet. We don't see these things in their true light. Now that you're novices, pay attention to them. Head hair is not beautiful. Body hair is not beautiful. Nails are not beautiful. Teeth are not beautiful. Skin is not beautiful. But people cover them with powders and creams and so on to make them seem beautiful, and so we're deluded and don't see the truth of things. It's like a fish that swallows the hook. Have you seen that? Actually, the fish doesn't intend to eat the hook. It's the bait that it swallows. If it saw the hook, the fish wouldn't eat the bait. It swallows the bait because it doesn't know what it's doing. It's the same for all of us. If you were to see these things in their true light, you wouldn't want them. Why would you choose to burden yourself with things like that? But it's like the fish. Once the hook is in its mouth, however much the fish wants to get it out, it can't. It's snagged. If you contemplate these five parts of the body over and over again and see them clearly, your mind will be at ease. Keep contemplating. Don't be heedless. Study these meditation objects and fear them like hooks. If you don't feel any fear towards them, it's because you don't know them. Once you're ordained, then be obedient. Follow the teacher's advice and instruction. Be respectful. Put yourself in awe of the Buddha and the training rules that he laid down. You must try your utmost to bring up a sense of fear and awe, a wise fear of wrongdoing and bad karma, a fear of breaking the Buddha's laws. If you constantly reflect in this way, you'll live peacefully, happy, and heedful. Now I will present you with your robe, this ochre-dyed robe that is the victory banner of the Arahants. Go outside and put on the lower and upper robes, put them on beautifully, evenly, all the way around. So Lumpur's comment about I'll give you a bowl and tomorrow morning you will put on your robes neatly and walk for alms in the village. So it brought to mind my own first alms round in the robes of a novice. So I went forth in July of 1978, 25-21, and it was the rainy season, and you know, I had practiced putting on a robe before. But then I will also, we went over to Wabapong, the main monastery, and I'd never stayed overnight there before. I lived all my time at Wat Pananachart, which is about five or 6 miles away. And so I'd never stayed overnight at Wabapong. And so when we went over and had the novice ordinations there, then we stayed overnight and then went on the alms round from Wabapong in the morning. So it was through the pathways that were not familiar to me. And I was the... Lumpur Cha had a way whenever there was foreigners involved in any of the ordination ceremonies, either as anagarikas or novices or as bhikkhus or as nuns occasionally, we would always go last in the ceremony so that all the foreigners would always be at the end of the group. So I was the last novice in the line going on alms round, and it was pouring with rain. So as you're going along, you have to have your alms bowl under your robe, and then you have an umbrella to keep the rain off. And then going along in a neat line, you're about a meter or 1.5 meters between you and the novice in front and the one behind. And so as you go past, then the villagers are out on the streets of the villages or by their homes, they're kneeling down. Then you come along, you lift up the lid of your bowl, and they put the sticky rice in. But you've also got to hold the umbrella, open the lid, receive the rice, and then put the lid on and continue on. And so this is kind of difficult. Also, your robe is falling off your shoulder. We don't have sort of zips and buttons and clips, so that. It was one of the most distressing experiences of my life, because I was getting further and further behind. I was the last novice in the line. I was taking me, my robes are falling off, and then trying to keep my umbrella up, so I was getting soaking wet, and then getting far behind, and thought, well, I can't run to catch up, because that's not very neat and seemly. And so it was... very anxiety-inducing experience, and so I was trying to stop, get my robes to roll them up again, get them on my shoulder, and then I'm further behind. And then which way do they go? And I keep up with the group. And finally, I got lost. as I said, I'd never been on those pathways before, and so the rest of the group had gone back to Wat Pathong. I had no idea how to find Wat Pathong, and I couldn't speak any Thai. So I'm there, sort of bedraggled novice with the rice in my bowl and my umbrella, and like, which way is Wat Pho Phong? And that was my... finally, I managed to find my way back, but I think then I didn't know what to do. Oh, should I come into the hall? Most people have already finished eating and are already washing their bowls, and should I go in the hall and sit down on the bench and eat there, or should I... What should I do? So it was one of those, well, it can't get any worse than this. That was the only comfort that I could experience, I could find in relationship to that. And that was about as bad as it got, because it was that is so far from the put your robes on neatly and wearing the victory banner of the Arahants. There's kind of a bit of a gulf between those two experiences, but I can look back, you know, with fondness, but it was not easy or pleasant. So that when you say putting on the robe, just even developing the grip in your fingers to roll it, it takes quite a bit of time. It's there's a certain, you're just not using your fingers in the way that you need to roll the robe up and have it over your shoulder. So it's testing you in many, many respects. So I'll leave it there for today.